was the first part of this course. You learned about perioperative nursing. A lot of you have been in the OR, probably all of you by now. You know a little bit about positioning. What kind of positioning is going to be involved for surgery on this part of the body? Somehow we have to get this exposed, don't we? So what parts of the body do you think have to be protected from any kind of nerve injury? And the neck, yeah. Kim, with your background in this area, can you think of any little wedge pillows or any little special things they use for this?
Okay. Not much, like you said, they're not going to extend the neck back right. But other than that, they're pretty much prone and, you know, supine.
Supine, not prone, supine.
Yeah, supine.
Yeah.
And they just expose, they cover everything, and they'll just keep whatever part, you know, that part open, and they'll cover everything else up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what do we know about the neck as compared to the abdomen, just spatially? Smaller, tighter, more compact. Important things there? Okay. So a thyroidectomy, when you see a word with ECTOMY at the end of that, what does that mean to you? Taking it out, like an appendectomy, like a hysterectomy, colectomy, taking it out. Okay, so this is something that's taking it out. Now, the exact type that they use and the extent of course, depends on the diagnosis and what's going on. Depends on what the prognosis of the situation is and what the goal of the whole surgery is. Remember I said the endocrine glands have a very good blood supply. So one of the things preoperatively for this kind of person is that they are taken off any kind of medications that they might be on, such as Coumadin or aspirin, that would prolong their bleeding time. And taking one aspirin a day of one size or another is very common in people over the age of 50 in order for that exact reason. So stop several weeks before any surgery to minimize the risk for any postoperative bleeding. Now, in terms of preoperative teaching and stuff, just refer back to your periop notes as to what might this type of patient need to have. A couple of things I wanted to get into before those exact points. What circumstance do you think the thyroid gland would be removed for? Poor grammar, but why would they take this gland out?
Cancer.
Some kind of malignancy, right? We talked about goiter on Monday, and goiter was not cancerous. It had to do with lack of iodine and those kinds of things. Different kinds of non-cancerous growth can cause a lot of swelling. Cancer of the thyroid doesn't necessarily cause a lot of swelling. It may, but it doesn't necessarily do that. Goiter is much more inclined to cause the swelling. Thyroid cancer is usually detected through palpation, which is why it should always be a part of any annual exam that a person has from a clinician and detect that. Is it in the right place? Does it feel symmetrical on both sides in front of the trachea? And is there any different nodular kind of feeling on it? So this is where the technique of physical exam of palpation from the clinician really comes into being. Is there anything nodular there? Same thing happens when a man is having his favorite activity, a digital rectal exam, for prostate cancer. There, the information is in the clinician's fingers in palpation. Are there any nodules on that gland? So it's a very important technique. So here they're feeling, and they can do this through the skin because of the location of the thyroid. This really doesn't take much, they don't have to go that deep or anything. It's not like trying to palpate the liver. not like trying to palpate the spleen. It's a little different. It's right there. So they're looking for nodules. And if there is something suspicious, if there is something there that says that, of course they have to do a biopsy in order to do a diagnosis. It's the only way you can get a diagnosis on cancer, a definitive diagnosis. And if that's what's been determined, and by the way, the who do you think has more thyroid cancer, men or women?
Women.
Women do. Mm-hmm. And this is a cancer of younger women. Younger women, 30s, 40s. Now, ask me why, and I'll say, don't necessarily know. It's just that those are some of the demographics that they have found out. So if this is a young woman who's at least going to her OBGYN, and as a part of that, the doctor is doing a little bit, he might pick something up, okay? And so this can be a curable kind of thing if this is picked up early. So we're not going down the whole cancer track right now, but we're talking about taking this out. The prognosis for it can be really quite good, okay? The treatment for it is surgery.
Since this is like really vascular here, is there the metastatic rate fast because of?
Well, it depends. You know, of course, after biopsy, of course they check out all the cervical glands because there are lots of lymph nodes in this area. And so certainly it can be there because of the reason you said, the vascularity. Yes, it can be there. So the treatment then would be surgery followed by chemo or radiation, depending on what is most appropriate for that type of cell. Okay, let's think back to, now let's get this person through this surgery. Diagnosis has been made, prognosis has been made, staging has been done, and we're just now talking about the surgery. For probably a relatively young type person, most likely a woman. Post-op care for this thyroid surgical patient, when she comes back to the floor, is going to be careful positioning, lots of drains. Could be as many as 4 or 5 Jackson Pratts. They'll put these in all kinds of places because they do not want any fluid to be trapped in this area. So when this person comes back from surgery, they're like a flower with all these things sprouting out from them, you know, and they feel like, ugh. Okay. So this person has to be moved and turned carefully and supporting that head, okay? And you want to avoid any tension on the sutures here, depending on where they make the incision, which is probably going to be here. Most comfortable position is a semi-Fowler's position with the head elevated and supported by pillows. Pillows can be your best friend at this time. Certainly analgesics for pain. There's going to be a fair amount of apprehension in this person and just a real carefulness, a kind of standing tall affect and yet careful of pain, concerned about diagnosis. Her life has been really rerouted at this point. There's a lot going on, and those of you who have been into surgery know about now the manipulation and what they do in there in order to do the job. So there's a lot of edema because the normal inflammatory response kicks in because of this planned trauma called surgery. What system do you suppose is the most important one for the nurse to assess and keep right on top of all the time? Respiratory. Respiratory, absolutely. So you're going to assess this respiratory status in an ongoing manner. This person is going to have oxygen with humidity going on. Any difficulty with respiration that does occur is usually as a result of edema to the glottis, back of the throat, or hematoma formation, that's a collection of blood in a little sac-like thing, or an injury to the laryngeal nerve. So those are the three bad guys or reasons for problems with respiration after this kind of surgery: edema of the glottis, hematoma formation, or laryngeal nerve damage. What?
Where hematoma formation? Where?
Just somewhere in there.
In thoracic
cavity. If the injury, if an injury to the laryngeal nerve has been incurred, then they will have to put an airway in place. Okay. Therefore, the kind of airway we're talking about here is tracheotomy. So a tracheotomy set is probably going to be kept at this patient's bedside in the beginning. Okay. It would not be uncommon for this kind of patient to go to an ICU for 24 hours just to make sure everything, because of the ratio of nurse to patient, because they can really stay on top of that. That's a little harder on a floor, you know that. No.
Or just the plain thyroidectomy in general?
Yes.
Okay.
Depending on the status, depending on how the surgery went, depending on the general status of the person. But because of all the drains and because of this concern that these three things, all of which could cause a respiratory difficulty, and then it has to be attended to right away, it's a little harder to do an emergency-type tracheostomy on the floor, in the bed on the floor. They can do that. Okay. But in an surgical intensive care area, the lighting is better, the equipment is better. They can just do that. So it's like pre-planning. It's like anticipating. If you anticipate a problem and you get everything in place for it, you know, maybe that's a way of keeping the problem from happening. So it's not uncommon for that to happen. I'm not saying it's a rule. It's always going to depend on the clinical picture there. And of course, if in assessing this person afterwards, you detect or pick up any respiratory difficulty at all, okay, you immediately contact the surgeon, because then that means another trauma to insert an airway. Actually, inserting a tracheostomy and doing that is like a knife stab wound, and they can do it very rapidly. But if you've got edema, or if you've got a hematoma pushing something over, or if you've got injury to this nerve that's not getting the message there, then an emergency kind of thing is warranted, and it's done. And it's another trauma to that area, but it is something that can be done. Okay. Of course, this person is going to have IV fluids, and there is going to be some difficulty with swallowing. PO intake is not going to happen right away, because they're going to wait until all the swelling and stuff goes down. Your job is to very carefully assess these dressings, respirations, respiratory status first, and you're looking for bleeding second. And whenever you assess a dressing of any kind of a wound, you don't just look at the top. It's much more important to look behind. Look behind, because fluid flows with gravity. You assess these surgical dressings regularly and reinforce them when necessary. You all know now that surgeons like to do their own change of the first dressing after surgery. You don't go in there and whip things off and do that, but you reinforce and pad and let them know. And, of course, if you're seeing obvious bleeding, you're writing, you know, circling that with a pen and putting the time. And then you're looking at it again, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever seems warranted by the situation, and seeing if it's growing, another reason to call. So respiratory status and hemorrhage are your things that you're watching for here. And I already mentioned the assortment of drains. And I've already mentioned that. Vital signs, of course. And be alert. Be very alert for any complaints of a sensation of pressure or fullness at the incision site. Pressure or fullness, because this may be what they are feeling as a hematoma develops, because it may indicate hemorrhage or hematoma formation subcutaneously under the tissues. So it's not anything that you can really see, because if it's a hematoma, it's contained. So you're not seeing it coming out to the dressing, but it must be reported. So your post-op assessment skills are right on top of this woman, really kind of picking these things up. Now, I'm aware that I'm sort of making it sound like these things are going to happen. Well, lots of times these things don't happen at all. But the best nursing of all is to cut it off at the pass. And you assess and you look and you keep something, you keep an emergency from happening by intervening and either reporting or doing what you need to do right away. And in this case, it's mostly reporting, getting the information back to the surgeon. This is what's happening here. After surgery, and after, I'm talking immediate post-op here, okay, and then we move into further post-operative time, and after 24 and 48 hours, and as the swelling and the edema from the inflammatory response starts to go away, and is a little more mobility, and then all the post-op things have to kick in, you know, the coughing and the deep breathing, not the splinting, because we don't have anything here, careful posturing, but the moving, the leg exercises, incentive spirometry, all of those kinds of post-operative things become a part of things. And the other thing that this woman is going to need, and rather than me saying this, let's see if you can come up with this. The thyroid gland has now been removed because it had a growth on it that was not compatible with good, healthy living. The thyroid gland has a function of secreting what?
Hormones.
So does this sound like there's a replacement hormone in her future? Yes, it is. Yes. So this person is going to have thyroid hormone administered for the rest of her life, because the thyroid hormone, T3 and T4 is what I'm talking about here, have to be given. This is a hard thing to make clear. After surgery, remember that negative feedback business and the thyroid and the pituitary and the hypothalamus? What they tend to do is give the thyroid hormone after surgery in heavy doses and in what would be considered suppressive doses in order to get the serum levels of it up high so that that message gets up to the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus says, oh, there's quite a bit of this circulating. I won't send a releasing factor to the pituitary. And the pituitary says, oh, don't need any of this. I won't send any TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone. I won't do that to what they call, they want to lower those levels to what they call a euthyroid state, or no thyroid-stimulating hormone coming at all. And this is to get the, this is to use that negative feedback message that there's enough in the situation, or in the bloodstream.
Is that just a temporary
thing? It's a temporary thing, yeah, to kind of re-stabilize it.
So they give you heavy dosages, like almost like a loading dose, in other words,
patients whose thyroid cancer is detected early and who are appropriately treated usually do quite well. The long-term survival rates are high for various forms of thyroid cancer. This patient will take exogenous, that's outside of their body, exogenous thyroid hormone to prevent hypothyroidism. They will have periodic follow-ups with careful examinations and body scans 2 to 4 months after surgery to detect any residual thyroid tissue that maybe wasn't gotten out, or any metastatic disease any place else. when they're ready to have these follow-up body scans and so forth, their thyroid hormones are stopped for about 6 weeks before the test so that they can get a cleaner picture without hormone interference. See what is actually going on in the body. Yeah, it is. A repeat scan then is done, a follow-up scan about a year after the initial surgery, and a final scan about 3 to 5 years after the surgery. So this is something that is followed along carefully, but like I said, the rates, the survival rates and so forth and recovery rates are really pretty good in this kind of cancer. The T4, TSH, and serum calcium and phosphorus levels are monitored on this patient to determine whether the thyroid hormone supplementation is adequate and to note whether calcium balance is maintained. And that's where that calcitonin comes in, which I'll be talking about in a few minutes.
So that was T4, T3, calcium, and
phosphorus. Mm-hmm. And this is a little, yes. Well, yeah, we're going to talk about that. We're getting there. Because those parathyroids are kind of embedded in the back of the thyroid gland. So, yes, that can happen. If they're, depending on where the cancer is, where the growth is, if they can salvage those, they will. But that's not the easiest task to do. But we will get to that. Just a little bit of an aside, but it's an interesting aside that it's good to know about. The thyroid gland has a very efficient mechanism to remove iodine from the bloodstream and store it, to concentrate it, to trap it for subsequent synthesis or the making of thyroid hormone. Kind of like stocking up on a favorite supply element. Like if you go to Sam's Club or Costco or something, you like to buy toilet paper or whatever. You like to always have a lot of whatever it is, okay? And you've got it out there on your shelves, so you don't have to think about that. The thyroid gland is very efficient at doing that to thyroxin or thyroid when it detects it in the bloodstream. And this thyroid trapping ability, I've got it typed wrong here. Well, thyroid trapping ability of iodine, okay? That's not because I want to be right. It's because that's what I was trying to say. Shows up and is reflected in a concentration of iodide in the thyroid gland about 20 to 40 times the usual concentration in the plasma. So it's just a factor that it has. It's an ability that the thyroid gland has. It's kind of good to keep this in mind in terms of the world that we live in with nuclear disasters and things, because if food sources, milk or other food sources, become contaminated with radioactivity as a result of nuclear detonation or nuclear power plant accidents, if any food sources become activated and they happen to have iodine in them, the radioactive iodine would be seen as a sale item at Costco by the thyroid gland, and it would really stock up. It's like, whoa, look at this. Okay, a lot of it would be concentrated in the thyroid gland at very high concentrations. And this then would irradiate the thyroid gland. This would not be good for the thyroid gland because this one would dramatically increase the risk for thyroid cancer. So this is an ability that the thyroid gland has to trap iodide from foods and whatever. And if it happens to be exposed to a disaster kind of thing, it's like a bonanza and it gets it all, but it's not good for the gland. Therefore, in communities exposed to increased radioactivity, they've done different things. They've done attempts to make or block the uptake of this radioactive iodine by flooding or saturating the thyroid gland with non-radioactive iodide. Like here, take ours first. It's a better buy. Okay, take this one. Take this one. And the thyroid gland then gets saturated with that one or other iodide preparation as soon as possible after exposure. So this is something that's known about the thyroid gland. So if there's a community that has a disaster like this happen, this is something that's known, and if they can, they can get non-radioactive iodide to these people to protect their thyroid glands from later development of cancer. Were they? Case of a nuclear accident of some kind. Yeah. Over time, or just stored to use.
But not through the thyroid. But if the thyroid was full and not absorbing all the radioactive.
Oh, you mean with the I guess. You get me in an area there that I don't know too much about. Yeah, yeah, it's a good question. Yeah. The last part I didn't get.
Well, they have to make adjustments in iodine consumption.
Well, they have to make a what?
An adjustment in their consumption of iodine if this thyroid gland is removed. Will they have to take supplements?
Might have to. I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, because if the person is still taking the same amount of the iodine and mm-hmm. there is no more thyroid, mm-hmm. where does it go? It will be going in the blood.
Yeah, I don't know if there is any benefit of it, because it's needed there in order to create the hormones that are needed. But if the gland is gone, is that what you're talking about? If the gland is gone, is this person as susceptible to radioactive iodine? Is that what we're talking?
What would we, as a healthcare professional, will stop iodine consumption of that patient or reduce the iodine?
The patient, which patient? That's what I'm not clear on.
The patient who has a removed thyroid as a result of the thyroid cancer.
No, this person has to have thyroid hormone supplementation for the rest of their life.
Iodine assists in making the thyroid hormones. When the thyroid is removed, there's no longer the need for the iodine to be in the system. Hence, obviously, it's getting flushed out somehow.
Yeah. So would we stop it or would we reduce the patient's iodine or no? We won't do anything.
Iodine?
Yes.
We probably wouldn't do anything with it because it's a natural part of foods depending on where they're grown and what they're done. We probably wouldn't do anything with it.
Well, you treat hyperthyroidism with radioactive iodine, right?
Hyperthyroidism.
When you have, all other treatment fails, that's the next treatment, right? So they're going to treat that with radioactive iodine, which you stated that it's gradually eliminated from the body.
Over time.
The urine, right? So is that what we're talking about?
Oh my, that's
tough. Not really. When I came across this and I decided to put a little bit of it in, I said to myself, you know, you're probably going to pay a price for this. Do you really want to go there? Because it gets so convoluted and difficult and tricky because of this negative feedback mechanism and all things that are going. And I guess what we need to do is take a step back and say, how important is it to go down certain roads in terms of nursing education? Interest level, okay, yeah. But how important is it to do some of those things? And probably not as important yet.
Radioactive iodine versus non-radioactive iodine, is it utilized by the thyroid the same way?
Is it utilized?
As far as creating...
Yeah, I don't think there's any differentiation
so
there.
So then by filling it, you're not taking
right.
away function, which is my question.
You're just putting the better thyroid in there. Yeah. And the body then would get rid of the rest. By saturating that thyroid gland with a lot of iodine, that's not radioactive. It inhibits the thyroid from absorbing the radioactive one. Okay? And because it's already saturated with the other thyroid or with the other iodine, it promotes the rapid excretion of any that it might have or come in contact with. Okay. And I'm not going to go into what you have to do to handle that excretion and all that kind of thing because that's not going to. Yes, yes. Well, let's leave the thyroid gland. It's gotten more than its fair share here. And let's talk about these tiny little glands. These little parathyroid glands. Oh, yeah, those are... And here I think you have to go back to your original thing because on today's handout, after thyroidectomy, it switches to adrenal cortex, and we're not coming to that until later. So write a note for yourself on that saying this is later. Okay. Now we're going back to your original one on parathyroid glands. So there are four little small glands embedded in the posterior aspect of the thyroid gland, and they secrete something called parahormone, which, as you can read there, is a protein hormone that has, and please highlight this or underline it or do whatever you do on your note pages when the instructor says, you need to get this, okay? Regulates calcium and phosphorus metabolism. Now, if you think back to just a slide ago, I think I was talking about one of the follow-ups for the patient who's had their thyroid removed was calcium levels, phosphorus levels, right? Thyroid hormone levels that are now being supplemented, yeah. This hormone, the parathormone, is one of the important regulators of blood or what's known as serum calcium and serum phosphate levels. This hormone plays a part in the process of bone formation and mineral metabolism. And the process of building bone or bone formation is highly complex. If you've done any reading in your text when we were doing musculoskeletal, you know that this is not an overnight phenomenon. And it's very involved, and it's an amazing thing that the body is able to regrow its bones. It involves the interplay between the action of the parathyroid hormone, calcitonin, which comes from the thyroid gland, and vitamin D. Other hormones in the body influence bone formation also, either directly or indirectly. Again, not a simplified situation. Let's go to the next slide. On this hormone. So, like we did with the thyroid gland, we're now going to look at the parathyroid glands and say, well, what if there's too much or there's too little? If there's hyper or if there's hypo? And this one is first looking at hyper, or an increased secretion of this parathormone. And what does it do? It results in more calcium absorption from where? The kidney, the intestine, and the bones. And the result of that then that would be picked up on a blood test is that the calcium levels in the serum, the blood calcium levels, would be higher than the norms. So excessive or hypersecretion of parathormone can result in high levels of this, which is, and you see this little last line down here, a potentially life-threatening situation. Calcium is supposed to be about 99% bound up in the bones, and it shouldn't be circulating around in the bloodstream. All kinds of things. The secretion of the parathyroid hormone, which sometimes you will see abbreviated with an acronym of PTH rather than trying to say parathormone. That's just to confuse you a little bit more. I think reading this stuff in the text is enough to make you a little crazy. Don't you think? Do you agree with me? Because, and I was looking into all different kinds of areas, but the acronyms and the letters and the alphabets and the forward and the backward and the negative and the positive, after a while you really feel like your head is spinning a bit, and I know that. So it's all regulated by negative feedback according to serum calcium levels. So this person, if there's a potential problem in this area, this is what their blood tests are looking for, serum calcium levels. Parathormone, or PTH, which is the same thing, parathyroid hormone is what that stands for, is released from the pituitary gland in response to a decrease in the plasma level of calcium. So when the level of calcium in the blood is too low, this is normally how it works, the parathyroid glands secrete a little bit of their PTH or parahormone in order to get some of that calcium from other places and get it back into the blood. Because it's a minimal amount in the blood, but that minimal amount is very important. Then it acts to, so what I'm talking about here is normal right now, okay? Then it acts to restore that concentration of the calcium ion in the blood to just above the normal set point. And when it does that, this then in turn inhibits further secretion of the hormone because of the blood signals of, whoops, there's enough, there's just a little bit more calcium in the blood we need, so we stop that. So increased serum calcium levels result in decreased secretion of this hormone, forming the old familiar negative feedback system. Got too much in there? Whoops, okay, we'll pull back. Gotcha, got the message. Now, this parathormone or parathyroid hormone, PTH, functions to maintain the serum calcium levels by doing a few things. One, by initiating the release of calcium from the bone, like going to another storehouse and saying, give me some of that. Don't ask me how. We're not going to go there. Would you suppose it's rather complex? Yes. Very complex. Do you suppose that orthopedic surgeons really need to know that? Yes. Do you really need to know that? No. But you do need to know that the ability of these hormones are tremendously powerful to do this, to get it to where it needs to be. So I'm talking about the parathyroid hormone and how it works to keep the serum calcium levels where it needs to be. If it needs some more, it goes to the bone and it's able to get the bone to release or give up a little bit of its calcium. It's able to get a message to the kidney to conserve some of the calcium rather than having it go out with urine. It is able to enhance intestinal absorption of calcium through the activation of vitamin D in the body. And it's able to reduce serum phosphate levels, because phosphate levels and calcium levels kind of work in tandem with one another. So by reducing the serum phosphate levels a bit, it can raise the calcium, the blood serum calcium levels a little bit. Now, if you're not confused by this point, I will say these four things again. I'll say them in reverse order. Okay? I'll start with the fourth thing. And we're talking about what the parathyroid hormone does in order to maintain or reestablish an appropriate, though small, calcium serum levels. That is its function to do that. One of the things it can do is reduce the serum phosphate level a little bit, because in doing that, the calcium level comes up a little bit. It's just a tandem kind of thing. And I'm not going to say any more about that than that. It can reduce the serum phosphate a little bit more, so it can get a little more calcium. Is there more to it than that? Yes. I am not going to go there. Thank you. A second thing that it does, and again, I'm saying these in reverse order, is it enhances intestinal absorption of calcium through the activation of vitamin D. Vitamin D, which is a fat-soluble vitamin. The activation of fat of vitamin D. A third thing that it does, that initially I said was the second thing, is it gets a message to the kidney to conserve calcium. And that first thing that I said initially, that now I'm saying fourth, is that it's able to get the bones to release a little calcium. So these four tiny parathyroid glands that are embedded in the back of the thyroid gland have a great deal to say about calcium levels in our body and where they should be. So they're very important. Hyper. Too much of this caused by whatever reason. There's too much of this hormone secreted by the parathyroid glands. We get a picture here of something that's characterized by bone decalcification, because what is one of the functions of the parathyroid hormone? To take some of the calcium from the bone. So if it's working too high, too hard, too heavy here, the bones start to, you know, they're having too much taken from them. So we have bone decalcification. Not a good thing, right? And since one of the other things that normally the parathyroid hormone does is talk to the kidney and say, hold on to a little bit of that calcium, because we need that here for the serum level of calcium. And if there's too much of that message coming, so the kidney just keeps following the directions and holding on to the calcium, and what can happen? The development of calcium-laden kidney stones or renal stones. So that's too much. Primary hyperparathyroidism, primary meaning that's where it starts, occurs 2 to 4 times more often in, what would you think, women or men? Women. This whole thyroid parathyroid business is much more geared toward the female gender. Now, this is something that's seen more frequently in patients between the ages of 60 and 70. Whereas when I talked about thyroid cancer, I said that was a younger woman's disease. Yes?
When a patient comes in with kidney stones, will they be checked for like thyroid and parathyroid?
Yeah, they will. Because kidney stones can be made, they can have a basis of several different things. And it's important, if they can, to find out what the source is, what are the ingredients of those stones. Same with gallstones. Secondary hyperparathyroidism that has similar manifestations occurs in a different group of patients. Patients who have chronic renal failure. It might be on dialysis. And they have this problem because they have their bodies hold on to too much phosphorus. We keep seeing this coupling of calcium and phosphorus, don't we? How there's a relationship here. Again, talking about secondary hyperparathyroidism occurs also in patients who have had increased stimulation of the parathyroid glands. And as a result of that, have increased parathyroid hormone secretion. Now, if you're going to ask me exactly what would increase parathyroid hormone situations, I'm not sure how to answer you. But for patients' bodies who have gotten the message and the parathyroid gland starts to do more than what it's supposed to, is really what I'm talking about, secondary hyperparathyroidism. These kinds of problems become very challenging. And very challenging for any primary internist. And what they will usually do is direct this person to an endocrinologist because they become exceedingly complex and hard to pin down what's going on. So what might you see? Well, you might not see anything. And then you might see a whole lot. So how's that for being really clear? Nothing or a whole lot. And if you look at that picture, and particularly the first line, you know, that goes with a lot of things, right? That's how I was feeling Tuesday in clinical. Yes.
If you're exhibiting these characteristics of hyperthyroidism, does that mean that there would be an increase in blood serum level, the calcium blood serum?
Yes. This long list of symptoms are all attributable to an increased concentration of calcium in the blood. That whole list. It's attributable or linked to an increased concentration of calcium in the blood. Psychological manifestations may also occur and may vary from emotional irritability and neuroses to psychoses caused by the direct effect of calcium on the brain and nervous system. This is another case of where an ingredient or a component of our normal physiology, of our very complex anatomies, is not in the place and in the amount or level that it needs to be. And it starts to be more so, or in the wrong place, it starts monkeying up the works and causing real problems. And I've just mentioned here, even into the nervous system and emotional and central nervous system. An increase, if you look at the second line here, nausea, vomiting, constipation, hypertension, and cardiac dysrhythmias may occur. That should stand out at you. An increase in calcium produces a decrease in the excitation potential of nerve and muscle tissue. Produces a decrease in the excitation potential of nerve and muscle tissue. Nerves and nerve endings and synapses always need to be able to immediately communicate with the muscle tissue that is there so that what can happen needs to happen. The formation of stones in the kidneys is related to the increased amounts of calcium and phosphorus that the kidney is being asked to deal with. Renal damage can happen to this kind of person with hyperparathyroidism. And this is one of the important complications of hyperparathyroidism, and it occurs in as many as up to 55% of patients with primary hyperparathyroidism. Renal damage results from the precipitation of calcium phosphate in the renal pelvis and in the parenchyma of the kidney, resulting in renal calculi or kidney stones, which can then, of course, lead to obstruction, pyelonephritis, renal failure, and in that whole thing, a lot of pain. So a clear connection here. You need to get a clear connection in your head with parathormone or the hormone from the parathyroid glands and kidney. Now, musculoskeletal symptoms is at the bottom of this list. And these can result from demineralization of the bones. Remember, we talked about that. Parathyroid hormone has the normal function of taking a little bit of calcium back from the bones to keep the serum levels where they should be. But if there's too much parathyroid hormone working and it's taken too much calcium, the bones then start to suffer. It's like, hey, you're taking all my marbles. You know. So the patient may start to develop skeletal pain and tenderness, especially in the back and in the joints. Experience pain when they're standing, when they're doing weight-bearing activities. May even get to the point where there are pathological fractures, fractures that aren't in any way connected to trauma, injury, or blunt force. Deformities or shortening of body stature. And of course, the bone loss increases the risk for fracture. There's also an association of an increased incidence of peptic ulcer and pancreatitis with this problem of hyperparathyroidism. They just see that as a correlation, something that they tend to notice. And I'm not going to try to make that connection any clearer to you. I'm just going to say those words. So what's seen here? Calcium lab tests. They're looking at calcium levels. Persistent elevation of serum calcium levels. Elevated level of the bad guy in this instance. Too much of a good thing. Parathormone in its normal levels is absolutely critical, necessary, wonderful, works well, keeps everything in its place. When we got too much happening, like it's gone a little mad or gone a little wild, we have elevated levels showing up in the blood serum. And bone scans or x-rays may show some bone change because too much has been leached out or taken from them by this increased amount of parathormone. So bone changes may show up with advanced disease. Other tests are employed to distinguish between primary hyperparathyroidism or malignancy as a cause of this hypercalcemia. Many more involved kinds of tests that would not be routine or usual kinds of screen tests, but when they're digging for the possibility of what might be behind this. Other things that could be used might be ultrasound of different parts of the body, MRI, magnetic resonance imagery, thallium scans. Fine needle biopsies have been used to evaluate the function of the parathyroids and to localize parathyroid cysts or adenomas, little growths, or just overgrowth of the parathyroid glands, hyperplasia. Whenever you see a hyperplasia, and that can come from, sometimes that's shown up rather frequently, as a matter of fact, on a pap smear of a cervix, hyperplasia, extra growth of those cells, extra growth of, quote, normal cells of the parathyroid glands can be a factor, a causative factor behind this. So how is it managed or dealt with? Is that tape still going, Carrie? Okay. Management of hyperparathyroidism. Well, one way is surgery to remove the abnormal parathyroid tissue. If it can be delayed and if there really aren't the severe symptoms and if there's only mildly elevated calcium levels, they might delay that. But this person is going to be told to increase their water intake, increase their fluid intake. There's an insidious onset and then a chronic nature to this problem of hyperparathyroidism. And it's diverse and it's often vague. Vague symptoms may result in frustration, depression, difficulties within the person themselves, frustration within their physicians because of the vague nature of some things. Family living with this person may have considered this person's illness to be psychosomatic. They may not buy it anymore. This is not helpful to a person who's having these vague symptoms that are hormone related. But nothing's clear enough. If surgery is delayed, the patient needs to be followed very closely for a worsening of hypercalcemia or the deterioration of their bone, any renal impairment, or the development of kidney stones. So this is someone who needs regular follow-up to make sure that progression isn't happening, so that we're not putting the kidneys or the bones at risk here. Because this patient is at risk for renal calculi, and the increased fluid intake that you see here is to prevent this calculus formation. Cranberry juice is one of the things that is suggested to lower the urinary pH. Patient is instructed to report other manifestations of renal calculi, such as abdominal pain or hematuria, blood in their urine. This person should never be given thiazide diuretics, because thiazide diuretics decrease the renal excretion of calcium. What do thiazide diuretics encourage the renal secretion of?
Potassium.
Yeah, they are not potassium sparing. And of course, the thiazide diuretics increase urination, just water, getting rid of water. This person who's living with this problem needs to avoid dehydration, because of the risk of a hypercalcemic crisis. So they should tap into their usual healthcare person for conditions that commonly produce dehydration. That would be vomiting, a severe diarrhea, anything that's going to deplete them of fluids. They probably need some fluid replacement. This patient should be mobile walking, or if they're sitting in a rocking chair, if that's at all possible. Because bones that are subjected to normal stress, weight-bearing, a resistance exercise, give up less calcium. So one of the nursing management things that we do for a person who has hypercalcemia, too much calcium in the blood, in this case we happen to be talking about it related to increased secretion from the parathyroid gland, is ambulation. Get this person moving if we can. Now, hypercalcemia is not only a problem with this situation. This is can be a crisis type problem with certain kinds of cancer patients that tend to cause this problem with a complex array of getting there. And one of the important nursing considerations for that problem, that person also, is ambulation. Get them moving. We get them moving, maybe we can save their bones. Their bones won't give up so much calcium. Keep that calcium where it needs to be, in the bones and not in the bloodstream. A crisis can occur if we've got way too much calcium in the blood, and the numbers are there. But this results in symptoms of neurovascular, cardiovascular, and renal that can be life-threatening. Treatment is rehydration with large volumes. Now, that's kind of problematic if a person has congestive heart failure, isn't it? Because that puts a lot of stress on the heart and lungs to traverse all that liquid. Diuretics, moving it through. And phosphate levels are going to go down with this, so they need to replace that. Acute hypercalcemic crisis can occur in this problem that we're talking about, which is hyperparathyroidism. And it occurs with these extreme high levels of calcium, serum calcium levels. The phosphate therapy that's mentioned in the bottom here is to correct the hypophosphatemia, because when there's too much calcium, there tends to be too little phosphate. Cytotoxic agents can be given. Cytotoxic, that word should bring to image something like chemotherapy. These are toxic to cells, medications that are toxic to cells. Mithramycin. 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 A lot of chemo-type agents or cytotoxic agents are anti-infective in nature in the way and by virtue of how they act. So I'm talking about things, phosphate therapy and other things, cytotoxic agents. Dialysis might have to be considered. The supplementation of calcitonin might have to be considered. These things can be used in emergency situations to decrease serum calcium levels quickly. Extremely high levels of blood calcium may result in shock, in kidney failure, and in death. And this is more common in the person with malignancy. And that's why it's considered a cancer care emergency situation. This patient who's in a hypercalcemic crisis, way too much calcium in their serum, requires very, very expert assessment and care to minimize the complications that can occur here and reverse what's considered to be a life-threatening situation, hypercalcemia. Let's, what?
How quickly can serum calcium levels rise?
Well,
also with broken bones, increase levels?
Yes. How quickly? I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that.
Feeling like this is a sudden increase.
Yeah, and that's how I've seen it manifested as a sudden kind of thing. They know that certain kinds of cancers are more have a track record of moving in this direction, and other kinds of cancers don't. One, for instance, multiple myeloma has this as a fairly common, if you will, complication problem as that disease moves along its course. It's better managed now. So they're always looking for it. Again, just like when I mentioned about good nursing is cutting things off the past. You're always assessing, you're always looking for them so they don't come up and bite you in the behind, so that you try to stay on top of them. That's the best possible way. Okay, let's look at the other side, and then we'll take a break. Hypoparathyroidism, not enough of this hormone. So it is obviously caused by a deficiency. The second line here is important to note. It's uncommon. Results in just not enough calcium level in the blood. And look at the symptoms that it causes. Irritability of the neuromuscular system. Too much tone in the muscle. So what are we going to see? Tremors, spasms, uncoordinated contractions. A kind of transient hypoparathyroidism can be a complication of neck surgery, as the parathyroid glands are disturbed by the manipulation and so forth. I'm not talking about thyroid surgery per se. I'm just saying neck surgery, because of their location, where it be, there can be a transient kind of problem. Initial diagnosis of the problem, no matter what its cause, can be difficult because of vague symptoms. And the vague symptoms that I'm referring to here that initially present themselves are in aches and pains. Is there anyone in this room who hasn't ever had some aches and pains? I mean, it's like, yeah, what am I supposed to do with that information? You know, it is very, very vague. Lab studies are helpful in trying to get to the bottom of this. As serum calcium levels go to 5 or 6 milligrams per deciliter, remember we said above 15 was like way too high. Now I'm talking below 5. If they get to 5 or 6, that's pretty low. And that's going to really end up resulting in some tetany or really severe muscle contractions. So tetany is a word that you need to know. It stands for really tight muscle contractions. And that's what starts to kick in and start developing at 5 to 6 milligrams per deciliter. Along with those low calcium levels and the muscle contractions are that serum phosphate levels are increased. And if x-rays are done of the bones of the body, you know what they're going to show? They're going to show too much calcium in there. They're going to show bones with increased bone density. So the bone density tests that have become a fairly common and important screening test for menopausal age women and post, to see how well their bones are holding on to the calcium and their density, for this person, it's too much of a good thing. Bones are going to show increased density. The management of this, well, the goal is to raise that serum calcium level. That's the intent, to raise it, because we're talking about something that's not putting out enough. And remember, this is a rare situation. I've never seen this. You're probably not going to see this. And of course, the goal is to raise the serum calcium levels and to eliminate the symptoms that go along with this hypoparathyroidism and the hypocalcemia. That's really what we're dealing with here. When this problem occurs after a thyroidectomy or other neck surgery, the immediate treatment is to administer calcium gluconate intravenously to decrease the neuromuscular irritability and seizure activity that can start. They also will probably give sedatives such as phenobarbital or pentobarbital. Not a fun thing to experience. Giving parenteral parathormone is not clinically feasible. And the reason it's not is there's a very high incidence, because they've tried it, very high incidence of severe allergic reactions to getting it by injection. This person has a very, what would be called neuromuscular irritability, very like right on the borderline of seizuring kind of thing. So the person with hypocalcemia and tetany, strong muscle contractions, requires an environment that is free of noise, sudden drafts, bright lights, sudden movement, sudden noises. Anything sudden like this can set them off. And this is exhausting. Their muscles and everything get exhausted. Very painful. If this becomes a chronic problem, chronic hypoparathyroidism, how would this be treated? Their dietary intake needs to be much higher in calcium than normal and low in phosphorus. And it's not fun to have a diet that's low in phosphorus. What's one of the things that would be eliminated from a diet if you were trying to not to curtail the amount of phosphorus?
Soda.
Right, any kind of soda. Milk products are high in calcium, but they're also high in phosphorus, as are egg yolks. Spinach is avoided because it contains oxalate, which could then form insoluble calcium substances. So the dietary control of this gets pretty tricky. Very, very careful. These people are going to be taking oral tablets of calcium salts. And then aluminum hydroxide gel or aluminum carbonate, such things as over-the-counter Gelucil or Amphigel, common antacid type things, is given after meals to bind the phosphate to them and promote its excretion through the GI tract so the phosphate doesn't build up in their bloodstream. So it's a different use of that type of medication. Variable dosages of vitamin D prep are usually required because vitamin D enhances the calcium absorption from the GI tract. You've probably learned that in nutrition already. Enough of this. Let's take a break. It gets weary after a while, doesn't it? Why don't we just switch the tape? And that way, yeah. Actually, I'll do that, Carrie. Push stop.